Hello and welcome back to Relatively Football, a women's football show hosted by siblings Theo and Flo Lloyd-Hughes. This is Theo calling in from New Orleans and I'm here with my sister Flo, who is at home in London. How are you, Flo? Good morning. Good afternoon. Good evening.
Good morning. Good afternoon and evening for me, actually. But what a bloody day it's been in London. What a day.
I know. I'm so tired. I feel like ever since I woke up, obviously quite late by your clock, it's been news flowing.
Yeah, it's been non-stop news. It did take people by surprise, the news, which we're going to get into in a second. But I feel like you don't see a lot of this sort of drama in women's football at a sort of day of sackings during an international break, which is so typical of men's football. We don't see that as much as in women's football. And although these sackings were probably justified, they still do come as a surprise. So do you want to maybe reveal, if listeners don't know yet?
Yeah, let's get to it. I appreciate you, listener. We talked a bit about social media breaks. I appreciate you, listener, if you're taking a break from the world. So as of Thursday morning, Matt Beard has left West Ham by mutual consent, and Karen Hills and Juan Amoros have been relieved of duties as co-managers of Tottenham Hotspur. It comes as a bit of a surprise, mostly, like you said, Flo, because we don't see this all too often, although obviously these teams will now have a three-week break to kind of get a new person in and get the team kind of up to scratch and how they want to move on from here. But it does come as quite a surprise, especially Karen Hills and Juan Amoros have been at the club so long. And in a short or two-year spell, Matt Beard has had some success at West Ham, albeit a very inconsistent tenure. Spurs have already announced their new manager, Rianne Skinner, a long experienced manager in the game, albeit as an assistant at Arsenal and Wales and England, currently was Phil Neville's number two, as well as lots of experience in the under-21s and youth academies. Flo, do you think either of these sackings were uncalled for or too hasty? Or do you think they got it about right with where these clubs are in the WSL this season and maybe where the projects want to be in the big picture?
I think they got it right. I think it's unfortunate that it was the right decision, especially in the scenario of Spurs, because I think it's really, really unfortunate because of what Karen Hills and Juan Amoros have done for Spurs. The fact that, where they've come from, what they've achieved, the fact that Hills took over when the club were in the fifth tier, and with this partnership now, they've managed to take them all the way up to the top tier, is pretty incredible. And I think it is a shame that they won't be able to maybe see the project through to a bigger trophy. Or, you know, last season was pretty good for them. It wasn't as much of a shock to the system, but this season has been disappointing. And I think the best way to describe it is Spurs outgrowing them and the club's ambitions going beyond the capabilities of those two as a pairing. Not to say they're not going to have success in their managerial careers again. I think they will. I think perhaps as a separate entity, though, because I think people were surprised that they carried on as a partnership, but it worked. But I just think, unfortunately, it was becoming really difficult for them. And in both the case of Matt Beard and Hills and Amoros, I think you do get to a point where it becomes quite obvious that the players are low on motivation, perhaps low on self-esteem and confidence as well. And it makes life really difficult to energise them. And I think you got a massive sense of that at West Ham. And it was really clear with Matt Beard, especially, he was doing those telltale signs of managers when they're struggling, where they just keep changing. They keep changing, they keep messing. And they just hope that something's going to work eventually. With Spurs, it was a little bit different, but with the signings and additions they've made, you need to see them push on and progress if you've got the backing of the club and they've, you know, opened their wallets. And we didn't see that. So I think both were pretty fair. I don't know if you disagree or, you know, it's harsh, but fair.
I think, I like the way you talked about where Karen Hills and Juan Amoros have come from. And I think that's what's really sad to see it change. But like you said, maybe this is just the end of kind of the Spurs chapter one, or, you know, how they become an elite club. I think looking at last season, this is a message from the top down that last season was the standard for Spurs. You know, a comfortable mid-table finish. That's what we expect now. And I don't think you can blame the higher-uppers for trying to impose that. I think it is sad also to see the only co-manager duo leave the WSL. I think that was something I really enjoyed. They don't think they have the best squad in the WSL, and I think maybe they sometimes have looked quite limited, and I don't think that's necessarily Karen Hill's and Amoros's fault. I don't think the same can be said for West Ham, who I believe have a stronger squad. And I think, like you said, we've seen Matt Beard chop and change a lot. And if you go and watch Squad Goals, which we've talked a little bit about on the show, that documentary, I think you'll see Matt Beard has struggled for fatigue, for ideas, for kind of energy. And I think sometimes, especially that last game, the way kind of he's managed someone like Rachel Daly and big players, I feel like he's run out of ideas.
Yeah, I think it's unfortunate that Squad Goals was such an eye-opener to behind the curtain, if you like. If anyone hasn't watched it, we've spoken about it on the podcast quite a bit at the start of the season. I think it's really interesting to now see what's happened and reflect on that. And West Ham, a bit like Spurs, they have big ambitions. They've put a lot of money relative for the WSL into this project. So they want to see some success and they need to see some turnaround. And I just think it's a shame because Matt Beard is clearly a great guy and has had so much success. You know,
he loves the club, he loves the players.
Yeah, two WSL titles with Liverpool in 13 and 14, got to the FA Cup final. So he has some good memories in the WSL, good memories with West Ham. I think he'll get picked up quite quickly because he's a pretty big name in women's football. It just obviously is the case that Spurs already had someone lined up. Otherwise, you know, someone like him would be picked up pretty quickly. I think if you haven't read it as well, read his notes app statement that he put out on his Twitter. It just shows everything about the man, about how much respect he has for the club despite everything. And last season, when they got smashed by Chelsea, he even said then, you know, is my time up? And maybe he should have gone then because it was a sign of potentially things to come. But the club backed him, they gave him money, they invested, they brought in new players, and it hasn't quite worked. But I think a new manager bringing new energy to energise the club and kickstart some of these players who have got very, very comfortable. He needs someone to, they need a manager to come in and challenge them and have players challenging for places, because there's experienced senior players there who are feeling very comfortable because they know that doesn't really matter what happens, they're still going to start.
Spurs obviously had Rianne Skinner lined up today to come in and be the new person in charge. And they had a good result last night, drawing 2-2 with Arsenal in the Conti Cup, which is obviously mixed emotions for Karen Hills and Juan Amoros, ending their tenure with a decent result to Arsenal. Matt Beard, we probably will have to believe, handed in his resignation today, or at least came to an agreement with the club after the weekend, but still took charge of the West Ham game where they won 4-0 against Charlton in the Conti Cup and looked quite good last night. Rachel Daly moved back into the attacking right wing position in a front 4-3-3, got two assists, Martha Thomas back on the score sheet. How do you think the midweek games affected these decisions at all, Flo? Or do you think it's irrelevant? Or do you think it's a sign that the players maybe cared about the managers? I mean, Spurs, for example, looked better last night than they have done in other times. Obviously, I only watched the highlights, but I thought Morgan looked really fit and physical, had a chance at the end where they could have won it in the 90, gets a bit put off by Katie McCabe, can't get it in the back of the net. Two more Siri Vorm assists. Obviously, Siri Vorm was playing very well under Karen Hills and Juan Amoros. Yeah, do you take anything from last night's Conti Cup results in regards to these sackings?
Not really at all, to be honest. The way it panned out with the results was quite strange, and we were all a bit confused going into it. The fact that Arsenal were knocked out despite winning on that penalty shootout, and West Ham winning, albeit against inferior opposition. I think the decisions were already sort of made by that point. I don't think there was much to fight against. I think it's a shame because I was looking at Karen Hills' post-match, which was the last thing posted on the Spurs women Twitter page before the announcement about them leaving. And she was saying she thought the North London derby game last night was the best that Spurs have played this season. Oof. Obviously, none of us got to watch the full 90 minutes, so it's hard to make an assessment. But that's a real shame if that's the case. And I do wonder how these events played out. In what time did these things happen? Was it did the players know as well? I think that was a question someone asked me about the West Ham result as well, and the situation there last night. Did the players already know? I think the writing had been a bit more on the wall for Matt Beard. That's the one I certainly saw coming, yeah. And we sort of floated the idea a little bit a few weeks ago, saying, you know, is it time
even
for him
after
to move
the 9-1? Seeing the interview with him after the 9-1 with Arsenal, it looked like he was almost ready to give up then.
Yeah, exactly right. So it's the Spurs one, which is a little bit more surprising, and in a sense, you know, losing in a Conte Cup penalty shootout isn't exactly going to be a deal breaker or a dramatic result that really pisses off the board. I think it was a series and a culmination of many different things, and perhaps Hills and Amoros said, you know what, off the back of a decent performance, before things get ugly, maybe it is time to go.
Yeah, I think it's going to be interesting to see now with this international break how Skinner, at least for Spurs, comes in and gets this team playing. I think Hills and Amoros have done, to some extent, maybe their ideas have got a bit stale, but I think they've done all right. And they definitely have made Spurs quite physical, a bit soft late on in games. We've noted how poorly they've done in the last half an hour of games. But I think with Alex Morgan coming back to fitness, her missing the first four or five games of the season, I don't know how much more they could have done. Obviously, no wins. You know, maybe if Ebony Salmon doesn't score that equaliser, are Hills and Amoros still in a job? You know, if you win that game, you're more comfortably not at the bottom of the table.
Yeah, that certainly wasn't a good look, given what Bristol had been through and the fact they didn't have any points on the board so far this season. That wasn't a good look. And really, Spurs should be trying to get very impressive results against teams like that if they're going to build. And they haven't shown any progress. They've just showed regression. But I do think it's interesting with this appointment, not someone I knew much about, but I've since read the FA Q&A, which I remember seeing, but I didn't really have a proper read of. But there is an FA Q&A that they did with Skinner. And it's interesting because Skinner has only just come into the job. She replaced Bev Priestman, who before she took the Canada job had dropped down to be head coach of, I think, the under-18s because she wanted a head coaching role. And Skinner has spent a lot of time as assistant coach, so this worked quite well. So it's going to be interesting step up for her, assistant at a big level, but still, this is, I think, her first head coach job, right? But she has all the makings and all the experience of someone who would fit this role perfectly. But what they do have on this Q&A is a bit of a sprinkling, an idea of what her philosophy is. And she talks about who she's learnt from the Laura Harveys of the world, who she was assistant to at Arsenal. So I think that's exciting. That's exciting to know that she's come from good stock. And I think it's a really good appointment. And hopefully, you know, she's the sort of person who's been in these bigger clubs, more experienced, big game situations. Whereas for Hills and Amoros, you sort of felt like they could only take them so far, having been at the lowest ebb with Spurs and done this incredible journey. It now feels right, I think, to pass on to someone who's at that higher level.
The real winners from all this news today, the turmoil and sackings and merry-go-round of the WSL, really are Birmingham fans, who will be holding on to Carla Ward, I imagine, unless she would dare go to West Ham. But I think Spurs
maybe
would
be rude,
wouldn't
it? You can't see her doing that.
I think she'll see out the season there. So Birmingham fans must be chuffed seeing the Rhian Skinner news come in so quickly. And the other winners are Arsenal, who have been seemingly all but knocked out of the Conte Cup, and yet the news is kind of not particularly loud online right now because of all the news going on with the sackings and the managerial hires. What do you think of this, Flo? Do you think you think much of their Conte Cup exit? At the end of the day, it all comes down to their 4-1 loss against Chelsea in the first match being too big a defeat. Do you think this says much about Montemurro? I guess on the flip side, it's one less cup competition to concentrate on, and they can really focus on the WSL.
I think they've just been a little bit unlucky with the way that the groups have panned out, and the regionalisation hasn't really helped them. I think if it wasn't for that, they probably would have had a better shot It's unfortunate because Arsenal have won this trophy 5 times. So to see them not progress into the latter stages is pretty shocking, because it's a competition that they will always have their eye on getting to at least the final. So yeah, it's really surprising. And if they had won that game outright last night and not let it go on to penalties, they would have qualified, right? So
yeah, they needed 3 points to win.
They needed all 3 points. So that's disappointing given the emphatic victory that they had in the FA Cup against Spurs. So I think that's frustrating one, and perhaps why Karen Hills was so impressed, because they really limited the damage and took it to a penalty shootout.
Pretty sure it looks like the final eight will have one of or two of Durham, Birmingham and Reading, I think, will be the best runners up. Birmingham basically just need a point against Leicester, and they should, if they get a point against Leicester, they should be all right. And if they don't get a point, I think it'll be Durham and Reading going through to the next round. West Ham obviously qualified with that big win, which is another reason I kind of thought maybe they'd hold on to Matt Beard, as I thought maybe they'd trust him in this cup competition. Reading got a really good 2-0 win yesterday, and that's put them through, well, not quite through, like I said, in a very kind of in the driving seat if Birmingham don't do well in their rearranged games. Chelsea are through, and Bristol City got a nice win at Lewis, putting them through 3-1. Did you see the goals in that flow? Really, really good goals.
I haven't yet, but I will look them up.
Ooh, Ebony Salmon's just absolutely on fire at the moment.
God, I bloody love Ebony Salmon.
Yeah, she was playing at left. So I watched this one, even though it was a bit of a dead rubber. Bristol were pretty much already through. Lewis were already knocked out. But I always like watching the dripping pan. So I checked it out, and it did not disappoint. Really high quality goals. Gemma Purfield from left back scored this kind of dink chip from the left hand side, went over the keeper, and then Ebony Salmon on the left hand side cut in on her right and kind of scored a screamer. But Lewis, to give him credit, won the second half 1-0 with a goal off a corner. And you know, they weren't terrible, but I think Lewis looked a bit sleepy, and Bristol, I mean, I don't know what Tony Oxby said to them, but they were really, that first 35 minutes, they were really playing and had so many chances for a game that they didn't necessarily need to win. They really, really wanted it. Anything else jump out to you from the Wednesday Conti Cup? Merseyside derby, I suppose.
I watched the Merseyside derby. Didn't quite bring as many fireworks as I'd hoped. Started really well. A lot of energy. Everton scored pretty early, and I thought, okay, we're going to have an exciting game. Liverpool got back into the game pretty quickly, had some really, really good chances. Rachel Furness, my fave, had 2 chances, really good ones. One of them was a low strike just inside the box from a corner that she should have done better, just went just past the post. She didn't quite make good connection with it. That was probably her best chance. And then she had another long-range effort that was quite far over the bar, but with the sort of goals that we've seen her score. So yeah, she'll be gutted about that. Unfortunate for Liverpool. They got that big result against Man United, but couldn't quite get the point. I thought they would scrape a point last night because they had such good chances. And actually, they did do well to sort of kill off Everton, but it wasn't quite the legendary Merseyside derby that I was hoping it would be.
Yeah, I felt surprised with some of Willie Kirk. He played Grace Clinton and rested quite a lot of players. Had Boy Halorka up front, who did well on that opening goal to get the assist for Christensen. But I was surprised Willie Kirk, you know, in the second half was bringing on Haley Rasso and bringing on Sorensen. And I think in a way, Willie Kirk will be disappointed it was only 1-0, because I think he didn't take that game lightly. I know there's a 3-week break, so arguably you could kind of go out and let your first teamers try and get a little bit of confidence before they got time to rest. But I think Liverpool can definitely take some credit from losing to, at least for the last half an hour, a pretty good Everton side, only 1-0. Anything else, Flo, from the Wednesday games? Like I said, we'll have to wait and see who's qualified coming through, but otherwise, maybe hope, pal. Oh, this is what I wanted to talk about. Did you watch the Brighton Reading? Two things, same note though. West Ham and Brighton games, listener, go and watch the highlights on the FA Player, because the way they catch Matt Beard, RIP, and Hope Powell on the mic is really brilliant.
That's what I do. That's my favourite part of the content.
I've got it written down.
Streams and
Matt Beard. So yes, this is it. Matt Beard, Lyon was brought down by Rachel Newborough. Right at the death, she's sent off the Charlton player, brings down Lyon, last player, and Matt Beard is heard on the mic just going, that's a disgrace. And then the Charlton, you can hear the Charlton bench complaining to the ref, being like, oh no, ref, no, that's not the right decision. Stop listening to the manager. So a bit of pantomime in the Charlton West Ham game. And then, Hope Powell in the Brighton-Reading game, which Brighton lost. There's a bit where Fliss Gibbons has a really good cross. And you can just hear Hope Powell say, lovely, lovely ball, Fliss. Good girl.
Fliss Gibbons has had a good season, to be fair. I've really enjoyed watching her play. So couldn't agree more with my good friend Hope there. Our assessment and analysis is very similar. You know, we both got our heads screwed on.
Maya Letizia on the other flank as well has been great. Hope started her first team back four last night with Gibbons and Letizia and Kirkdyke. So it was kind of a strong-ish defence from Brighton, but then they rested a few of the attacking players and obviously didn't get a goal to show for it. Okay, well, let's take a little break before we come back with Thursday night's Conti Cup action, and we'll catch our breath after all that news, and we'll be right back to you. See you in a bit. Hello and welcome back to part two of Relatively Football, where we'll be going through the Thursday fixtures in the Conti Cup, as well as trying to figure out exactly who will be in that final eight. And before we get there, Flo, I was remiss to forget a question we had from a listener, Francesca Tate, about the sackings of Matt Beard, Karen Hills and Juan Amoros. They just wanted to know, do you think managerial sackings will start to become more prevalent in the women's game after this?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I hate to constantly make the comparisons to men's football, but the short...
Men's football? Never heard of it.
Never heard of it, mate. The short-termism in football management is very common in men's football, especially in the higher leagues, Premier League, Championship. You know, most clubs that... I would say probably a quarter of clubs in each division lose managers every season. I mean, that's just a guesstimation, but definitely in the Championship.
Probably higher if you include like off season.
Yeah.
But during the season, like within the actual season, probably 25% sounds about right. But
yeah. Maybe more so if you include obviously, we've got fewer teams in these top two divisions, which we tend to focus on. So because of that, you're obviously not going to see as higher numbers. I think the demands of football management and women's football is really intense. And I think probably part of that, you know, went into Matt Beard's decision and situation. It must be really difficult for managers to manage during this pandemic and all the extra pressures of testing and cancelled games and the sporadic fixture list and injuries and everything. So I think the intensity is added to it, but then you've got the unique aspect of women football, which plays into part of it. So yeah, I definitely think we will see more of it, and clubs are getting more ambitious too. So with ambition comes that expectation, and so we will see clubs being a little bit more impatient and saying, actually, you know, we've given you money, we've given you time, and we're going to move on. Whereas before, perhaps the expectation wasn't there as much with some of the other clubs when you just had people like Arsenal winning everything.
Yeah, I think maybe you look at managers like Carla Ward, who've come up and done such a great job as well. I think you might see people, I mean, Rianskin has been in the game a lot, but maybe people thinking outside the box are looking at who's doing well down the pyramid, and that might become more of a food chain for more sackings and more turnover. I think last year there was one sacking, the Birmingham boss mid-season, Marta, and the year before I think there was one sacking as well. So you're looking at least doubling the amount of sackings mid-season in the WSL. So that is definitely means it's going up. I guess we'll see next year.
Yeah, we had a big issue with Liverpool season before last, where Neil Redfern left.
Well, that was a resignation. Yeah. Oh, I wasn't really thinking of that.
I know, but I always count them as the same, to be honest. I know it's not really the same.
Well,
but
I think 18-19 had a few more then, because I think Mark Skinner left.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Sacking paints it in a bit more of a negative light.
So, moving to Thursday, we were graced with another Manchester derby. This one had the same result, but slightly different teams, a different verve, and maybe not quite the spectacle. Ending 0-0, it went to penalties, and Ramsey, the backup keeper for Manchester United, was the star of the show. Flo, your nemesis, Alex Greenwood, was... the villain of the piece, having her penalty saved by Ramsey, tipped onto the bar, and the bonus point was given to Manchester, although they have been knocked out of the Conti Cup. before this because they weren't able to pick up a win, so that bonus point won't do them much good. How did you feel about the game? Did you learn anything? What can we take away from a good City point? City will be top of the group. They're through to the final eight. How did this one make you feel?
I thought United looked like the better team, had the better chances. Really, Tobin Heath should have put away her chance.
That was the one where she kind of had her back to the goal and she was like shimmying left and shimmying right.
It was a back pass, I think, from Alex Greenwood. And she passed it to Karen Bardsley. Bardsley did a swing and a miss, tried to kick it. And then...
My heart, even though I have no... Listener, I do not care about either of these teams, but I got so anxious for Karen Bardsley when she...
I mean, it is one of the most embarrassing things you could do as a goalie. And you end up on a DVD when you do something like that. But yeah, that was such a good chance. And she just hit it first time, but she was pissing about with it in the box. And then it was too late and she was crowded. And to be honest, City did well to recover in the end. And there were a few other chances. Sanaforth had a good one. Mewis hit the bar late on. That was probably City's best chance. Rose Lavelle was absent. I know you said she picked up a knock.
That's what I read on social media, but there's sort of some conspiracy theorists out there saying other things.
Probably me. Mainly me thinking that there's something going on there. I don't know. I'm just reading far too much into it. But yeah, Lavelle was absent. But both managers put out two strong teams, which I think is a good sign. Obviously wanting to progress. We've talked about how a competition like this was perfect for Man United to progress in and get some silverware. I think they'll be really disappointed. It's unfortunate that they had a really tough group because of this regionalised situation. They had by far the toughest group with City, Everton and Liverpool. The Liverpool defeat will be what really hurt them. They've still got that Everton game to play, like I said, but it's meaningless now. So really, it all comes back to that Liverpool upset where... Perhaps it was a bit earlier on in this real good patch of development and progression we've seen over the last few weeks. It was just before they really kicked on and things really clicked. And there was some weaknesses there, which I think they've been able to iron out. I think one of the biggest things I picked up on was Casey Stoney during the sort of team talk bit before the penalty shootout. Didn't really talk to her players at all. And I know I listened to her post-match after the City game and she talked about how at half-time she always leaves the players 5-10 minutes max to talk things through themselves and solve their own problems. And I know some managers do that, but I think they tend to do it at the end of the game. So after the result, or especially if it's a defeat, they'll leave the players in the dressing room and they'll let them talk it through and kind of digest things for themselves. But I thought it was really interesting that she did it for the penalty shootout. Yeah, it was a bit of a meaningless one because they couldn't progress anyway. But it was just really interesting because I've never really seen a manager do that. Whenever it goes to penalty shootout, I've always seen a manager in the huddle with a piece of paper, chatting through, pointing, saying, you know, you're going to take the first one, you're going to take the second one, or who wants to take one, etc. She literally just stood on the sideline and didn't really interact with anyone. She was talking to her coaches and the physios and stuff. But apart from that, everyone was just left to their own devices to be in a circle. So she clearly is putting a lot of responsibility and power in her players and expecting them to show a lot of maturity, which they did. And it'll be interesting to see how this progresses and if this is going to be a regular thing for them going forward. And she will continue to give them a lot of the responsibility.
Yeah, I thought United had maybe the better of the 90 minutes, but I thought a draw was probably fair. I think Sam Mewis, who came on in the second half, was the best player on the pitch. And increasingly, I'm starting to think, I don't think anyone's figured out how to play against Sam Mewis. On the weekend in this same fixture, she was fantastic and was so free to move between the lines.
Yeah, she's unplayable.
And Hayley Ladd, Katie Zellum was on when Mewis came off the bench, and then Stoney brought on Hayley Ladd to try and kind of seal that spot in defensive midfield, and Mewis was just running over Gronen and Ladd. And so I think low stakes game, United didn't really get anything out of it, but I think City will know that they maybe have one of the best players in the WSL who even some of the best teams haven't figured out how to play against. So it was a gentle reminder that Mewis, even in a cameo, is just top of the league. I like the way you're talking about Casey Stoney, Flo, so I'm going to let you in on something. You didn't manage to watch any of the Durham Villa game on Facebook? This game was...
No, I heard I saw the tweet about technical difficulties, meaning it wasn't going to be an FA player. And I also had, alongside the United City stream, I also was on a Zoom webinar, sort of talk event.
It never stops.
Featuring good friend of the show, Maggie Murphy from Lewis.
Love it.
As well as JJ Rubble, amazing referee, changing the game, that the Hurricane Foundation were doing. So I was sort of listening to this panel session and watching the Manchester Derby, and I don't think my brain could cope with another window open. I think it would have turned to mush. So I was leaving that one to you, so you can give
I'll go off on that one. Well, it was interesting because Gemma Davies, Durham were great. They came out in the first half and really shook Villa. Incredibly high tempo, incredibly high energy, physical, first every ball. They got an early goal, bit of a lucky goal, but they were well worth it. Had a couple of decent shots. And at half time, Gemma Davies took her team talk on the pitch. It was one of those kind of games. And Davies rested a lot of players and definitely seemed to be regretting it. I think they were not expecting Durham to be this good. And so Davies had the Villa players out in their trackies, keeping warm in Durham, in a cold Durham night. And she really kind of laid into them, made two changes at halftime. Steen Larsen in particular came on and completely changed the game, was fantastic in the second half. And Villa looked really great, kind of 45th minute to the hour, to about 70th minute. Larsen wins a penalty, kind of a 50-50 tackle. The Durham player maybe got some of the ball, but definitely got some of the player. And then Borthwick makes this amazing, heroic leaping save, just guesses one way, goes right. The ball was cracked right. Really decent hit, but amazing save. And so you kind of feel like it's going to be Durham's night, but then Follis has a free kick from about 35 yards out that scoops up and bounces just in front of the goal. And Borthwick, who'd been so brilliant in the penalty save, lets it go in. And it was kind of weird to see a keeper who'd had a really good game save one from 12 yards and then concede one from 35 yards from two dead ball situations. You don't really see it that often. But it turned into a really good game. And they kept reminding us on the stream, you know, these Durham players have other jobs. They're part-timers. They've probably worked their 9-to-5 and then they're playing tonight. And Durham City only made one change from the weekend. This was pretty much their best 11, and you really saw it. They really dug in and they really tried in this game. And I think Villa looked really good in the second half, but 1-1 was probably a fair result. And Follis, who scored the free kick, steps up and blazes the first penalty over. And at that point, you're thinking, are Villa going to lose this penalty shootout and lose the top spot in the group and maybe a place in the final eight? And Sean Rogers, the Villa backup keeper who was in for this game, comes in and makes two fantastic saves in the penalty shootout and gets Villa the penalty win, gets on the top place finish. They're in the Conti Cup final eight, and Durham are in second place. But Durham will be in the best runners-up group, because with that extra point, I think they'll be well and truly through. So it was a good night for both teams, a good spectacle to see, you know, one of these professional teams with a men's Premier League team attached to them. Kind of go up against the top of the table Championship side, who are non-professional. It was a really good end-to-end game. Like I said, I think the energy of the game was amazing, especially after watching the Man City Man U game alongside it, which was a good game, but definitely seemed quite sleepy. And, you know, both teams made a few changes and they played on the weekend. But Durham were not. They had the bit by their teeth for a lot of this game. And credit to Gemma Davies in a way for turning it around, because at half time you really thought Durham were going to go on and win by a couple of goals.
Excellent match report. Thank you so much.
Thank you to Durham for putting the Facebook stream together. A couple of lovely lads on the roof. They were on the roof of somewhere. They kept saying, "Oh, we're on the roof."
That's what we like to see.
They had a nice link.
Old school.
They had a nice link asking people to donate money to a food bank because they're not paying for a match ticket or for the stream. So, credit to Durham City for getting the stream there. It was a lot of fun and the game lived up to it. Like we said, that puts Villa through on the top, and Durham are definitely through as a second place. Palace got a big win tonight, which has put them in the pole position for the other runner-up place. Birmingham will need to win their rearranged fixture with Leicester to try and get in. It looks like a draw will not be enough after that big Palace win. And Everton, even more complicating now, will probably get a chance to get through as the best runner-up, but they'll need to put about 4 or 5 goals past Man United in that rearranged fixture. So the chaos of the Conti Cup and its points per game, goals per game format is about to be well and truly tested. Any more for any more tonight?
I don't think so. I did try and have a deep dive to find out when the draw is going to happen for the quarterfinals, but I couldn't find a date. It's not really surprising given we don't even know when the final games are going to be played that got cancelled. So I'm not massively surprised, but it'd be good to know when that's going to happen. The FA today announced the rejigged opening rounds of the Women's FA Cup. So that's already a bit delayed. So obviously this is meant to be the first trophy of the season. We've already sort of had one trophy with last season's FA Cup. So I think it'd be good to get into these latter stages fairly quickly. So I'm hoping if they reschedule those games for after the international break, so sort of early December, get the draw done straight after that, and then we can get some quarterfinals played at some point in December. That would be great.
Crack on. It's going to be a great quarterfinals, like I said, especially with some of these championship sides creeping through as well. So really look forward to it. Well, that's our roundup of the Wednesday-Thursday Conti Cup, and we'll be back in a minute just finishing off looking ahead to the Euro qualifiers and other stuff going on around the world in women's football. See you in a bit. Hello and welcome to Relatively Football Part 3 on this bumper midweek action podcast. We're going to be taking you through what to look forward to on the Euro 2022 qualifiers. Sorry, I had to double check my years just there. So Flo, we're nearly there, or nearly there and thereabouts, about 18 months away from the wonderful European tournament we'll be hosted in England. Who can qualify, or who should we be looking out for in the matches going on this weekend?
Yeah, so it's a weird one because obviously the tournament's been delayed. So we are heading into the final stages of qualifying, but we've still got a year and over a year to wait until we'll actually see any of the tournament. But hey ho, we march on and we continue. And actually, it's kind of extended international break for a lot of players. So most of them will be heading off to camp straight away following these Conti Cup games. And I'm going to focus mainly on home nations, including Ireland, because I think that's probably what most people will be looking out for. And in a lot of the other groups, the qualification is kind of already been decided. So this is a nice one where we can kind of still root for some people who are still in the hunt. So in Group E, where we have Scotland, who made it to the World Cup, obviously. Some of our favourite players, I would say. Kim Little in there, Erin Cuthbert, Caroline Weir.
What an assist Claire for Emsley. Kim Little yesterday, by the way. I don't think we mentioned
that. Yeah.
Got to give some love. Liquid Football Arsenal. I know you're at the tournament, but oof, Kim Little, still got it.
And one of the few clips you can actually watch as well from that game. So it makes it even sweeter. But yeah, what a goal. Rachel Causey, one of our faves. So Scotland, they're still in the hunt. They lost to Finland last time out, which was not good. Finland are currently top of the group. They're 4 points ahead of Scotland, who are in third. And that was a really difficult defeat for Scotland, because if they'd beaten Finland, they would have given themselves a really good chance to qualify. A bit like the frustrating situation with the Conti Cup, Euro qualifying is a little bit confusing as well. So there's three places for runners-up. But they have to have the best record against the sides first, third, fourth and fifth in their group. So that's why it's a little bit confusing. So technically all the home nations still have a chance of qualifying, but it is quite difficult for most of them, to be honest. So Scotland have got two games to go. They're playing Finland in first place, Portugal in second place. Portugal's the game they play first next Friday, then they're going to play Finland on the 1st of December. They got to win both games, basically, to have any chance of going through in one of those runner-up spots. Ireland also still technically in the hunt in Group I for one of those places, but unfortunately, a bit like Scotland, disappointing defeat to Ukraine.
They have it all to play for, but they've got to beat Germany, one of the best teams in women's football. So that's going to be a real struggle. And if they have any chance of going through, they have to beat Germany, who are top and already qualified. So that's going to be a real challenge. Obviously, we'd love to see them go through, but it's just a shame that disappointing results have made it a real struggle for them. Group C, we've got Northern Ireland and Wales there. Northern Ireland have two games to play, which puts things a bit more in their favour. They're going to be playing Faroe Islands and Belarus, so two of the worser teams in the group, which isn't great when it comes to trying to qualify as a runner-up and be the best of the worst, if that makes sense. So they've got games against Belarus and Faroe Islands. They sit in third with 8 points. Wales are 3 points ahead of them. They've also got to play Belarus, but they are 7 points behind Norway, who have already qualified in top spot. So it's going to be difficult. Northern Ireland and Wales are sort of battling it out for that second place. We'd obviously like to see either of those teams goes through. I think Wales is probably my preference because they've got a lot of players I like, Jess Fishlock especially. So it's going to be tricky. It's going to be really tricky, mainly because of their record against the better teams in that group. So to try and qualify as one of these best runner-ups is going to be a challenge. But if they beat Belarus and kind of just hope for the best and see what happens, then, you know, you never know. But after coming so close to qualifying for the World Cup and missing out, they were in England's group for that qualification, it will be really sad if they don't. But it's so difficult when you're calling in players for international duty and stuff, as we all know. So, yeah, all to play for, but the majority of the spots have been claimed now for the qualification. So we're just waiting for these final ones. But for all the runners-up that don't automatically qualify as those three best record groups, there will be opportunity to qualify via playoff, you know, dramatic and stressful way to go into it and winner-takes-all kind of situation, but it will still give them a chance to be in the hunt, but they have to be in a runner-up spot. So that's why the Wales-Northern Ireland situation is tricky, but we shall wait and see.
And so that will be taking place, actually not this weekend, but I think the weekend after, like you said, kind of end of November, December. Anything else on qualifiers before we wrap things up?
I think that's it.
Yeah, on staying on the international circuit, the US Women's National Team announced their squad for their camp and fixture, their first fixture since the She Believes Cup. They'll be playing Netherlands on Friday the 27th of November, which is the day after Thanksgiving. Quite a fun one for the American audience, as well as definitely one to check out if you're in the UK or anywhere else in the world. The Muir sisters are staying reunited. Lindsay Horan has sadly tested positive for COVID, so we'll be missing that fixture. And Flo, there is a certain left-back who is left out of the Holland squad. Do you think that's a bit unfair? I'll leave you, listener, to guess which Dutch left back was crudely not picked. Also, shout out to Kieran for putting us in touch with the Dutch listener and trying to get to the bottom of
who embarrassed
the
you.
Jackie Hoonen situation. I've been doing a bit of research of my own, going on some Dutch YouTube channels. Trust me, there'll be more on this on a future episode as we get to the bottom of Jackie Gate. Amadine Henry is back in the French team as well. Diakra's standoff has been formally closed for now.
An olive branch of some sort.
And Lyon are playing PSG on Friday. If you can catch that one, I think it's on Atta Football and ESPN Plus in the USA, Optus Sport in Australia. Definitely one to look out for. And other kind of women's football things to catch this week, listener. Ada Hedenberg has a new documentary out on ESPN Plus in the United States. Highly recommend it. Just went out last night, I think. And if you have the ESPN Plus streaming service, you'll be able to check it out. Unless you've got anything else, Flo, why don't we wrap it up there? And you can follow us on Twitter at RelativelyFoot. Check out the Instagram. We've got loads of fun stuff there. Flo knows the password now. We're trying to make that its own little space to do some goofy stuff and share some love. So yeah, Instagram at RelativelyFootball, email relativelyfootball@gmail.com. And yeah, share us, like us, listen to us. We'll have a fun new siblings interview next week, right, Flo?
We will, yeah, indeed.
Yeah, keep an eye on Monday. No WSL this weekend, but lots of Relatively Football podcast action coming to you. So we'll speak to you soon. Cheers. Thank you.